If you're asking me, do documentarians and do I selectively withhold information until the right dramatic moment, the answer is yes.
Timing is everything in filmmaking, as we learned this week from The Jinx. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Wikipedia is suing the NSA for a spy program you likely haven't heard about before, and the case makes even PowerPoint seem important.
The real question, I think, is going to be whether a federal court thinks one PowerPoint slide that suggests what the government plans to do is enough to prove what it has done.
And as rising tides threaten Florida, there are a few words conspicuously missing from the state government's lexicon.
There was one lone reference to climate change in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of the report, that the people I talked to just thought must have slipped by the censors.
It's all coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. We begin with revelations about the National Security Agency eavesdropping on American citizens. And no, this isn't a rerun. You're already probably aware of PRISM, which leaker Edward Snowden exposed as vacuuming up IP addresses and phone numbers. But as the president protested in 2013, no actual conversations.
They are not looking at people's names, and they're not looking at content.
It turns out, however, that the NSA is also gathering the content of conversations and other internet activity in a different electronic spying program. This one is the subject of a new lawsuit against the NSA. It's called Upstream Surveillance, which monitors far more intimate information in searching for evidence of terroristic intent. Last week, the Wikimedia Foundation, along with a half dozen media and human rights organizations, sued the government over Upstream, alleging infringement on privacy and free speech. Stephen Vladek, co-editor-in-chief of the blog Just Security, says the NSA has set up shop where it can see and hear everything.
The Upstream program basically has the government sitting as a traffic cop, literally on the information superhighway and intercepting traffic as it goes through particular servers and taking the information, quote, upstream, unquote, of when it enters the United States. And the key to the Upstream program is that a lot of what the government is collecting is content.
And let's be clear of what we're talking about when we say content. We're talking about text of emails, records of searches, browsing activity.
And perhaps even phone calls. But the government is supposed to take steps to eliminate, to not even look at, to not access data collected through Upstream that they reasonably believe to involve U.S. persons. One of the concerns that has arisen in the now 18 months since the Edward Snowden leaks has been just how effective those procedures are to abate the Fourth Amendment harm of collecting that information in the first place. That's one of the questions this lawsuit is trying to raise.
Now, I first read about this about a week ago in an op-ed by one of the parties to the suit, Jimmy Wales, founder of Wikipedia. And I went, wait, what? This is classic eavesdropping, including internet activity by Americans from American soil. Why are there not villagers massing in the streets with flaming torches?
So I think it's important to add a couple of caveats about the Upstream program. It's primarily targeted at non-citizens outside the United States. Reasonable people will certainly disagree about the policy wisdom of, for example, spying on Egyptian democratic activists in Egypt. There's no question that, at least under current law, those individuals don't have U.S. constitutional rights. They don't have an expectation of privacy in those communications. But the way that the government is collecting this information upstream, it is simply inevitable that the government is also going to be collecting emails between me and friends of mine in Egypt and between lots of Americans and friends of theirs overseas, in which at least U.S. persons and non-U.S. citizens lawfully present in the United States have an unquestioned expectation of privacy.
There have been a lot of lawsuits related to the PRISM program and other NSA spying activities. Is this one different? Is this one stronger, better?
I think from a constitutional perspective, this lawsuit is in some ways much more important than the ones that are already pending in the other cases, in the suits challenging the PRISM program, in the suits challenging the bulk telephone records program. The basic claim is that the doctrines on which the government is relying are outdated and need to be updated and adjusted for technological change. Here, the basic claim is that the doctrine clearly prohibits what the government has been doing. So in many ways, this is perhaps the biggest case, albeit one that has some procedural obstacles to surmount before we can get to that question.
If the lawsuit gets anywhere in the federal court system, there's two pretty significant obstacles that you've identified. One is the question of standing. Jimmy Wales, for example, and Wikimedia, the parent organization of Wikipedia, believe that their activity has been monitored by the government, but they can't necessarily prove it, and they can't necessarily prove harm. Will they have standing for the purposes of being a recognized plaintiff?
That's the million-dollar question. There's a very important Supreme Court decision from 2 years ago called Clapper versus Amnesty International, and at least before Snowden, and that's when the Clapper decision was handed down. It was handed down in February of 2013. Those plaintiffs could not show that surveillance of them was, in fact, certainly impending. The critical difference here is one PowerPoint slide that was released by Edward Snowden and that has Wikipedia as one of the internet sources that the government was going to use these programs to collect information from and about. The real question, I think, is going to be whether a federal court thinks one PowerPoint slide that suggests what the government plans to do is enough to prove what it has, in fact, done, since there's no other evidence that these specific plaintiffs were subjected to upstream collection.
One final thing. We're going to have Jimmy Wales on in a moment talking about the chilling effect that this has on American citizens. I have to mention a Pew Research Center survey, which was just released, titled Americans' Privacy Strategies Post-Snowden. And it turns out that America isn't all that chilled. It's more like chill. 34%, a third of Americans who had heard about the PRISM program, which is 90% of the population, say that they have taken one step to protect themselves from government intrusion. Two-thirds have done nothing. Is this why there are no villagers in the streets with flaming torches, that America, for the most part, just doesn't really care?
I guess I'm not yet convinced that that really is a global statement about all Americans, or whether it's just a reflection that there really are two different mentalities. There are the folks who either don't care about their privacy or simply assume that any steps they take will be pointless because the government will override them anyway. And there are the folks who care quite deeply about their privacy but are increasingly finding it more and more expensive, more and more logistically burdensome to protect that privacy in light of the known capabilities of the government. And at the end of the day, I have to say that, you know, as long as that second group is more than just a de minimis segment of the population, I think we all have a responsibility to support them. So I do think it is an undeniable trend that most Americans seem callously indifferent to privacy these days. But if anything, that makes lawsuits like these that much more important, because it suggests that it's going to be the courts and not the legislatures that are going to be the last bastion of real privacy protections in this digital age.
Stephen, many thanks.
Thank you.
Stephen Vladeck is a professor of law at the American University Washington College of Law. Jimmy Wales is co-founder of Wikipedia and board member of the Wikimedia Foundation, which is a plaintiff in a lawsuit filed earlier this month, along with eight other organizations claiming that the NSA's surveillance violates constitutional protections of free speech and privacy. Jimmy, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
A previous suit against the NSA was dismissed because the plaintiffs couldn't prove any actual harm. Not theoretical harm, but actual harm to actual individuals. Will you be able to do that?
Yeah, we will be able to do that. We will have specific evidence put forward in the case, which unfortunately I can't talk about right now. But as we go into court, we'll be producing specific examples of the harm.
Could you give me a hint? Is it bigger than a bread box?
Yeah, it's people. Human beings are bigger than bread boxes. And so when we talk about people who are not willing to contribute in the public sphere because they're afraid of the surveillance that's going on, whether they're U.S. or overseas or what have you, those are the kinds of things that we're looking at, is to say, actually, this does make a difference and that people are being spied on.
I want to go back to the moment you saw the slide from the Snowden revelations that specified Wikipedia as a place for the NSA to snoop around. What went through your mind?
Oh, I was outraged that they're actually monitoring in a whole-scale kind of way the traffic in and out of Wikipedia. It is outrageous, and it really pushed us to move forward more quickly than we would have with plans to make all connections to Wikipedia encrypted, which is still a goal we haven't quite hit, but that is the direction we're heading. And one of the policy assumptions in pursuing this kind of thing is that it's possible to continue doing it. There's a very strong movement online for all communications to become encrypted, and I think that's a great thing. It's probably not what the NSA wanted, and it's probably not what would have happened had they limited themselves to a regime more consistent with our legal traditions of probable cause, get a warrant, get a subpoena, those kinds of things.
Now, I should say, Jimmy, that although there was this PowerPoint slide that came out in the Snowden leaks, it was a slide from a presentation suggesting Wikipedia as a target, not documentation that it had been a target. But assuming they followed through, is there any way for you to have divined in these 2 years the names or IP addresses of any specific American, you know, whose activities were tracked?
Well, as I understand it, it's basically all of them, that this is upstream surveillance where they're collecting huge amounts of data on just about everyone, and then they attempt to some extent to sort out who's American and who's not and which parties of the conversation are. But that's got to be an incredibly inaccurate and virtually impossible task.
In fact, the protocols are such, as I understand it, that if they do realize that they're eavesdropping on an American, they've got to go, forget that. And it's presumably not acted on. I suppose that you and your co-plaintiffs believe that's an impossibility.
Well, yeah, it's definitely an impossibility. And even if they are doing that, I think this raises concerns anyway, because the freedom of expression is intimately tied up with the freedom of association, and the idea that the chilling effects of, if I'm in a conversation with someone on Wikipedia and that person is overseas, does that mean that now my conversation is subject to being spied on? It's a super complicated thing to even imagine how you could sort all that out.
There's your lawsuit based on constitutional principles, and then there's just the very idea of all of this. Your co-plaintiffs in this suit include Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International USA, the Rutherford Institute, the Global Fund for Women, and others. Irrespective of whether the federal courts entertain this litigation and change the behavior of the NSA, is it possible that as a pure matter of public relations, that global outrage could shame, let's say, the president into ordering these practices to stop?
I think it is possible. And I think one of the things that, for me, I find quite tragic about the whole thing is that I travel around the world, I meet with politicians in various places around the world, and I'm, as a free speech activist, I'm always pressuring them to say, don't arrest bloggers and open up your internet. Surveillance on everyone is a bad thing. And now the U.S. has lost the moral force in those arguments. We can hardly complain about the Chinese people spying on everyone if we're doing the same thing. And I think that is when we really ask ourselves about our foreign policy goals, the proper foreign policy goals, not sort of short-term real politics stuff, it should be about spreading the idea of democracy and freedom of speech and expression and human rights. And when we fail to live up to the best practices and standards there, it makes it very, very difficult for our politicians to go out with a straight face and lecture the world on these things.
Jimmy, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Jimmy Wales is co-founder of Wikipedia and a board member of the Wikimedia Foundation. Zealously protecting the homeland, of course, is not limited to spying on citizens. It also includes ferreting out sinister citizen spies. Case in point, Stephen Kim, former senior advisor at the State Department and current prison inmate. One morning in June of 2009, Kim returned a call from Fox News reporter James Rosen, and that was opportunity knocking. Kim, a nukes expert and a hawk on North Korea policy, wanted the United States to punish North Korea's nuclear provocations with more than toothless diplomatic protests. A few phone calls and one foggy bottom stroll later, Rosen posted an online story headlined, quote, North Korea intends to match UN resolution with new nuclear test. This was fairly conventional wisdom, but it was also the conclusion of a brand new classified intelligence report available to Kim. Because the reporter and the source did a very poor job of covering their tracks, and because the Obama administration wanted to make an example of a leaker, Kim was charged under the Espionage Act. He's now serving 13 months in prison, having lost his job, his savings, his marriage, in addition to his freedom. Peter Maas is a journalist at The Intercept, which in February published a long article titled Destroyed by the Espionage Act about Stephen Kim. Peter, welcome back to On the Media.
Great to be with you.
When James Rosen's story broke on Fox News, clearly he had info from a classified report. What was the reaction in the White House and the CIA and elsewhere in the intelligence apparatus?
The reaction in the White House was fury. There were people, particularly on the National Security Council, who read that story and were familiar with the classified report that it referenced. They were upset basically about two things. First off, that a classified report had been leaked, and secondly, that it had been leaked within hours of it being distributed at the top levels of the United States government. And this was, for them, one leak of many that had been happening, and it happened to fall at a time when they decided to start cracking down in a big way.
One of the reasons they decided to start cracking down in a big way is that someone dug into previous cases where investigations had been started into the breach of classified information and zero indictments, not a single person made an example of, and Stephen Kim was very much in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right. For many administrations, perhaps for all administrations, there have been complaints about leaks and how they're terrible and they have to be stopped, but pretty much they all tolerate them. This is where the Obama administration, however, decided to take a different tack. And the different tack that it took was when it looked at the record and saw that there were all these referrals for investigations but no indictments, that was going to stop. That, as Dennis Blair told the New York Times subsequently, it was necessary to hang an admiral, to make an example. And Stephen Kim happened to talk to James Rosen just as this review was getting underway.
Well, they wanted to hang an admiral, but it was more like an ensign. And furthermore, he was an ensign who was doing what ensigns in his position and various kinds of bureaucrats, even at the highest levels, have been doing in Washington for a century, which is playing out policy disputes in the press. Absolutely common practice, no?
It's beyond common practice. I mean, it's almost uncommon for this to not occur. And it's something that also is not just a matter of practice, but a matter of health in the sense of political health, so that we know, hey, there are differences within the administration over policy X or Y. And the only way that we find out about these sorts of things is for officials to go outside of whichever department they work for that isn't responding to their complaints and talk to journalists and say, hey, there's a problem here. Look at this.
It is clearly a very large gray political economy that is participated in by everybody, including administrations themselves.
There is classified information that government officials discuss with journalists on a virtual daily basis, and they discuss it because this classified information makes the administration look good. A successful raid in Somalia, a successful negotiation with Iran. And therefore, the information is released to reporters without authorization by the president necessarily. But nobody bats an eyelid. And the very odd and frustrating thing about this is that Stephen Kim was not even accused of handing over a document, a piece of paper, or a thumb drive. This was a discussion about which, by the way, the government had no proof of what was actually said. There were no recordings. There were no confessions. There were no emails between them about what they had discussed. There was, however, an incriminating amount of metadata that put these two men in the same place at the same time talking about something, and the government believed it was this classified report that Rosen later wrote about.
But, you know, Kim lied to the FBI. He apparently divulged some hot off the presses intelligence. There was a crime committed. In taking up this case and devoting the time and resources that you clearly did, I mean, I don't know how many months you invested in this story.
Many.
And inciting the horrific effect on Stephen Kim's life, he is impoverished by the legal defense. He is imprisoned. He has lost his family. He has been despondent to the point of suicidal thoughts. That's a powerful narrative you spin. But have you chosen the wrong case to make an example of? If the government overreached, doesn't the Edward Snowden case show there was reason for them to want to make an example of somebody? And your poster child is someone who apparently did the deed.
Well, an unjust prosecution is an unjust prosecution. The fact that there are, let's say, lots of murders going on out there, perhaps even serial murders, does not mean that somebody who is a pickpocket should be arrested and charged for homicide. And that's more or less, in my view, the context of the prosecution and destruction of Stephen Kim, who was a very loyal, very concerned civil servant who had a conversation with a reporter that he probably should not have had.
And by the way, when they left the building to meet one another on this blind date, the date was set up. The Yenta was a senior member of the Public Affairs Office at the State Department. So to some degree, it was actually sanctioned by his superiors, if not the actual act, at least the relationship with James Rosen.
You know, there's all kinds of muddying context that really brings some light to this case. There's kind of a hypocrisy where one arm of the government encourages one form of behavior and another part of the government prosecutes that form of behavior. That's a very confusing situation.
If it's true, and it is, that this is the way policy and journalism have been symbiotic for a century, is that going to change?
Without sounding too New York Times-like, I would say the answer is yes and no. Are people scared off? Yeah, for sure. I've had that happen, you know, with sources of mine, and other journalist friends of mine have had that happen with sources of theirs. However, when you look at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, The Intercept, and the list goes on, you see every day amazing stories based on classified information. I can't speak for other journalists, but I do think a bit of what is happening is that there are a lot of journalists who are redoubling their efforts. It's harder to get this information, but we're trying harder to get it. And it ain't over.
All right, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Moss is a senior writer at The Intercept. Coming up, climate change? Who said anything about climate change? This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, it's Brooke, and I'm jumping in here because we're doing a special episode next week on cancer in the media, and I want to hear your thoughts on a couple of questions. First, if you have cancer, what cancer words make you cringe? Have you invented any new ones to reflect your experience? Also, What do you think about how Hollywood depicts cancer? Does it do a reasonable job? Does it really screw it up? If you've got specifics, we'd love to hear them. Record a voice memo on your smartphone and email it to otmwnyc@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 917-409-7830. 917-409-7830. Also, please tell us your first name and where you're calling from. Thanks so much.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Remember the mayor of Amity Island in the movie Jaws? He was played by Murray Hamilton in a gathering panic. The only thing louder than his resort wear was his opposition to using incendiary language like shark and eaten alive. Scares away the tourists.
It's going to be one of the best summers we've ever had. Now, if you fellas are concerned about the beaches, you do whatever you have to make them safe. But those beaches will be open for this weekend.
The great white man-eater to the mayor of Amity Island was what you'd call an inconvenient truth. The most famous inconvenient truth, of course, is global warming. Although here again, you'd never get an official of the state of Florida to say so. As described in a report by the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection is prohibited by Governor Rick Scott's administration from using the terms climate change and global warming in any official capacity. Instead, environmental officials are reduced to using euphemisms such as nuisance flooding. Tristram Corton is a journalist for the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. He spearheaded the investigation. Tristram, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Give me a brief overview of the effects so far of global climate change on the state of Florida.
As Rick Scott said, I'm not a scientist, but we're facing a lot of, obviously, sea level rise. This is leading to the threat of saltwater incursion into our freshwater supply. A lot of our native flora and fauna, especially marine-based, face devastating effects like coral reefs. I'm told it is the number one threat to them, and they're already endangered. Florida is looking at having to outlay a fair amount of money to protect its infrastructure, roads, seawalls, property. They're going to have to come up with plans to help protect all of this.
To protect the citizens, but also to protect what is probably the biggest industry in the state of Florida, which is?
Tourism.
Aha, tourism. Just like Amity Island. Is it as simple as that, that the state that so depends on tourism and the real estate industry just doesn't want to frighten away outsiders with scary terms like climate change?
So the governor's office gave us a few word response. There is no policy. And the Department of Environmental Protection gave the exact same wording. There is no policy. And by which they probably are technically accurate. There's no written policy. You know, what we discovered was all communicated verbally.
So what did you discover? You do have people telling you what they were told not to tell you.
A local conservationist who writes a column in the monthly Biscayne Times newspaper approached us and said, listen, this has happened to me twice that I've been told by the DEP not to use these terms. And the first time was when he was contracted by the DEP to write a series of educational fact sheets about coral reefs and the threats they faced. He and his partner wanted to use climate change, and it was taken out of their report, and they were told not to use it. And then he volunteered to take a slideshow, essentially, to community groups about threats facing coral reefs. And in this case, they sent him an email saying, you can't use it. If you do use it, got to make clear it's not coming from the state. So then I just started calling ex-employees. A former attorney in the office of the general counsel for the Department of Environmental Protection said, absolutely. I was told at a staff meeting by my supervisor not to use these terms shortly after Rick Scott was elected and shortly after he appointed Herschel Vineyard as the director of the DEP. One ex-employee said that this was known as a department-wide policy, and it interfered with reports that this person was writing about the economic impacts and how to address them, and yet she couldn't use the term.
Now, this strikes me as a kind of Orwellian approach to language, and it could have a couple of explanations. One is the Jaws scenario, where the Scott administration just doesn't want to scare away tourism and investors in Florida real estate. And the other is a pure political matter most of the Republican Party, of which Scott is a member, refuses to embrace that global climate change is significantly man-made. And to use terms like global warming could be seen as betraying one of the major planks of the party platform. Is that what's going on here?
I don't think the two potential drivers of this that you described are exclusive. I think that there's a lot of fear about the impact global warming will have on industry and tourism and real estate in this state. It may very well be they don't want to send people into a panic, and that damping down these terms in official communications is going to help accomplish that.
Now, euphemistic language is one thing. Policy is another. Did you discover any evidence that the degrees to which the state strains not to speak the obvious aloud also causes them to pull their punches in environmental protection itself?
That is the $60,000 question. Now, in this story, we really had to spend all our effort trying to verify essentially these semantics. We're going to have to take a look at whether or not this essentially attitude has impacted the policies that are going to get us prepared to deal with these changes. It seems logical to assume that even if you're working on this stuff, the fact that you can't use these other terms makes you that much less effective, right? So you could be that much better if you were able to just state straightforwardly what is accepted science.
Tristram, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tristram Corton is a journalist for the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Some people dubiously delete obvious facts. Others pass along obviously dubious hogwash. Over the last several months, Craig Silverman, author of Poynter's Regret the Error blog, and a fellow at Columbia's Tau Center for Digital Journalism, has been tracking the way rumors and unverified claims spiral through the news. He founded the website Emergent not only to trace the rumors, but to track how the press deals with debunking them. Well, patterns are already emerging, and they will make you sad.
When it comes to the misinformation problem online, news organizations are in many ways more a part of the problem than they are a part of the solution. One of the most clear things we saw was that when a news website chooses to talk about something that's unverified, something that's circulating but we're not sure whether it's true or false, there's a lot of kind of pointing and then retreating. They don't apply reporting, they don't apply verification, and they often don't actually come back to that particular claim once it's been resolved. One example of a claim that we tracked was a report that a mass grave that had been discovered in Mexico was connected to the disappearance of more than 40 students who had been at a protest. And we saw a good number of news organizations jump on that. And it took a little more than a week to resolve itself, where they did DNA testing on the mass grave and found out that it didn't belong to the students. And then we went back to see how many of those news organizations actually wrote the follow-up story to say, hey, it turns out that these students weren't in the grave. We found that it was roughly about 35% who actually kind of closed this loop for readers. So we saw them jump on in the early stage, and the majority of them did not come back to it in any meaningful way.
One of the problems you've identified is a different standard for the reporting within the body of the story, within the text, and the headline summary.
What we saw, the surprising amount, we saw what we call a headline-body dissonance. News sites who would take a rumor that was unverified and write a headline that actually clearly says that it's true, then in the body text they would walk that back and they would use allegedly or reportedly or things like that. And an example of that comes from Vox. They had a story about the protests in Hong Kong. So here's the headline. Hong Kong's protesters are using the same hands up, don't shoot gesture used in Ferguson. And then if you actually read the article, you then were greeted by a sentence that says, it's impossible to say the degree to which protesters are using the gesture as a deliberate nod to Ferguson or borrowing something they'd seen on the news for their own purposes or using it coincidentally.
What is the dumbest single thing that you have seen reported without any level of appropriate journalistic skepticism?
We logged a bunch of news sites talking about a sighting of Bigfoot in Russia. There was a video. It was clearly fake. It was a man running in a hairy suit. And news sites said, hey, Bigfoot in Russia?
Ah, the question mark, which absolves you of any responsibility for the fundamental ridiculousness of the story.
The question mark is actually a very serious issue. It's been studied, and it's called an innuendo headline. So if you're going to put kind of a claim or an accusation in a headline, and you're going to put a question mark on the end of it, the way that people read that headline is first they have to understand the claim. So they process that as true, and then after that, they add on the question mark. And so in most cases, they lean towards believing it as true.
Tell me what advice you do give to news organizations to stay off of your radar.
When it comes to rumors, one of the most important things that journalists have to understand is that no matter how we do it, when we decide to give a rumor a little more oxygen, when we decide to kind of point to it, we're giving it an element of credibility. Just talking about something and saying, well, it's rumored or it's allegedly or reportedly, the fact is that there's a connection between repetition and belief. The other thing that I think is really interesting and useful is to understand that, you know, rumors emerge in specific contexts when there's uncertainty, when there's fear, when there's lack of information. And so if you look at rumors not as something to just jump on quickly and put up there, but as a reflection of a very human process at play of people trying to make sense of something, then maybe you start to understand the motivations behind the rumor and you can tell a better story.
Complicating the problem, scholarship has made more than clear that even when the media do try to debunk a rumor, that the very process of debunking tends to cement the misinformation in the minds of people who don't necessarily want the debunkitude.
Yeah, this is called the backfire effect, where deeply held views are challenged. Our instinct is not to say, oh, let me understand your point of view on this. It's to double down on those beliefs and to reject what's being told to us. And this is one of the reasons why debunking is so difficult. Another reason is that when you're the debunker, you're almost like a spoil sport. You're kind of ruining the joke, especially when it comes to an entertaining story. A lot of research has found that what you actually need to do is tell a causal narrative saying, well, actually, here is why this is what happened. And when you do that, people can replace that misinformation with the new narrative in their mind.
You have an example. Can you tell me about the condoms?
I would love to tell you about the condoms, Bob. So there was an image that was created by a guy on Twitter, and this was back in the fall when, of course, pumpkin spice products were everywhere, and he decided to mock up an image and share it on Twitter of a pumpkin spice flavored Durex condom. And then over the next few days, the image starts getting taken and used by other people to the point where a reporter with Quartz sees this condom circulating and wonders, well, are they actually making this? Rather than just sort of write a post saying, hey, there's a pumpkin spice condom, maybe? She actually called the company and called their PR rep and tried to get an answer. And
Wait. A reporter reported? Stop the presses.
It was like the heavens had opened up. It was just amazing. And the PR firm couldn't really tell her either way. So she published an article saying that Durex can neither confirm nor deny the existence of the pumpkin spice condom. But Durex responded relatively quickly. Within a few hours, they denied that they were making one. They put out kind of a playful tweet about it. And the amazing thing that happened was we saw a huge pile-on of news sites now suddenly writing about the pumpkin spice condom. And all of them were correctly saying that it was not real. So this was the most debunked claim that we had seen. There were many, many times the shares for the debunkings than for the initial false reports. The other thing that I think was really key about this, I talked about debunkers often seeming like spoil sports. Durex made a little joke about spicing it up in the bedroom when they denied the existence of this condom. And the fact that they actually played along with the joke, a lot of the articles that we saw debunking it were able to still make all of the pumpkin spice condom jokes they wanted to. So they didn't kill the joke. They opened the door to fun debunkings. And I think that's one of the reasons why lots of people still decided to write about it.
All right, Craig, thank you.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is a fellow at Columbia's Tau Center for Digital Journalism and the founder of the rumor tracing website, Emergent. Coming up, the truth, the whole truth, and the jinx. This is On the Media.
Amber Ruffin has been a black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last week saw the bombshell finale of the HBO documentary series The Jinx, director Andrew Jarecki's inquiry into three probable murders and their elusive suspect, Robert Durst. Spoiler alert, the next few minutes will reveal more than some may wish to hear, beginning with the climax to end all climaxes. It was the film's subject in a bathroom, unaware he was being recorded, apparently confessing.
What the hell did I eat? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kill them all, of course.
What the hell did I do? Durst muttered. Kill them all, of course. It was a stunning denouement to six episodes of some truly gripping television, what one commentator called the true crime series we've all been waiting for. Even before it aired on Monday, Durst, the squirrely New York real estate heir, was under arrest for murder. But soon, the search for deception and manipulation shifted from the film's subject to the filmmakers themselves. Much has been made of the final confrontation between Jarecki and his subject, when Durst is asked to compare a note he wrote to one of the murder victims with an anonymous letter sent to the Beverly Hills police. They are in identical block letters, and both add an extraneous E to Beverly. And Durst knows the implications.
Well, I mean, the writing looks similar, and the spelling is the same, so I can see the conclusion the cops would draw. Or the writing exemplar person would conclude they were both written by the same person.
That breathtaking moment is triumphant partly because the filmmakers have spent much of the final episode struggling on camera to get Durst to sit in for that final interview. Then, providentially, Durst calls them at his lawyer's behest. They're seeking some raw footage that might help Durst be to charge of stalking his hated younger brother, and Jarecki thinks he's regained the upper hand.
They're saying, Bob, if you don't want to go to jail and you want to have a good defense here, you need Jarecki and Smerling to give you the defense. Obviously gives us a lot of leverage.
Thing is, the leverage, Durst's arrest for violating a restraining order, took place more than a year after the crucial interview. That is, after Durst faced the damning evidence and wandered obliviously to the men's room in a cold sweat with a hot mic. And what of the months that elapsed before the producers informed police of the apparently incriminating letter, and the 2 years that elapsed before they claimed to have accidentally discovered the accidental bathroom bonanza? And yet, Durst's arrest came propitiously on the eve of the finale. By Tuesday, the filmmakers had canceled scheduled media interviews and also declined our request to appear, explaining they don't wish to interfere with the ongoing prosecution. But the issues of documentary ethics do not begin nor end with The Jinx. Joe Berlinger, with his late collaborator Bruce Sanofsky, directed a previous HBO true crime documentary, the acclaimed Paradise Lost trilogy. It also chronicled three murders, the gruesome 1993 killings of three little boys in what was thought to be a satanic ritual. The trilogy ultimately secured the release of three West Memphis, Arkansas young men wrongfully convicted of the crime. Berlinger says that the pressure is constantly on filmmakers to wring out the maximum drama and suspense from inherently confusing events.
You know, when you do things like stylized recreations of gruesome events for the participants who live them, when you put yourself on camera, as many filmmakers do, as the crusading investigator. You know, I get notes from networks all the time about upping the entertainment value, upping the suspense. And, you know, real life doesn't naturally fit a conventional dramatic arc. And we, as makers of this kind of work, are under increasing pressure to conform to the conventions of scripted television. That doesn't mean it's wrong. It just makes it a very interesting time for documentary.
And it's the very techniques, the ones you just enumerated, that inflate the drama, but also, upon any reflection, would tend to diminish trust in the filmmakers themselves.
I think there's a larger issue here. I mean, first of all, I believe that all filmmaking, all media is inherently subjective. Just the process of whittling your footage down is a series of decisions. How you choose to frame your shot, you low angle, you know, suggests one thing, a high angle suggests another.
In fact, in Paradise Lost, there's this one moment where you capture the stepfather of one of the victims, a guy who is a part-time clergyman. And there's a shadow of one of the pieces of, I think, of recording equipment on his forehead that looks very much like a pentagram. And, you know, it's to gasp to see that, especially as the story plays out.
Well, I mean, that was a true found moment. It was around Christmas time. They were putting a miniature Christmas tree on the grave of their newly deceased son. And because of the angle of the sun and the angle of the head of that stepfather, it reversed the image of the star that was on top of the Christmas tree to being an upside-down star, which is what a satanic pentagram is. It was a chilling moment to observe and a chilling moment in the film.
Your style of filmmaking is to simply let the camera do the talking. You have no audio narration. Every now and then you insert a title card to set time and place, a little bit of context, especially when there's been quite a bit of elapsed time. But you do show up in the film Paradise Lost. That is in the form of a conversation where a possible murder weapon is being examined in court, and the source of the murder weapon was you guys.
At the grave of the deceased son of one of the stepfathers, we were given a knife by him as a present, which was an unusual present to give, on Christmas Eve. And when we went back to our hotel room, we opened that knife up, and there was blood in the hinge, and it was a serrated knife. And these children had multiple stab wounds on them that were consistent with a serrated knife. And so we were confronted with a serious ethical dilemma, you know. Was this potentially a piece of evidence? What do we do? Do we violate this relationship that we have with our subject by turning this knife over? What would that mean for the film? You know, we felt that if we turned this knife over, it would undoubtedly shut the film down because the filmmaker-subject relationship is so important in gaining and maintaining access that we felt that this would really be kind of the death knell of our project. Within 24 hours, we were back in New York, meeting with various executives and legal representatives at HBO, and collectively we made the decision that good citizenship trumps any filmmaking need, that doing the right thing was more important than our film project, and that if we had come into possession of a potential piece of evidence, we had a moral obligation to turn it over.
And yet the filming continued. You took your project to fruition, and then in two subsequent installments. How did the fact that you became a participant in the investigation alter the filmmaking process?
The first film was purely an exercise in cinema. You know, we came to film a story as it was unfolding. And because we thought we had witnessed this incredible miscarriage of justice, we assumed that the first film was going to have a major impact on the case. And when the film was ignored by the authorities and the outcry was ignored by the authorities in Arkansas, we felt we had a duty to make a second and a third film. And that's when we passed from, I think, neutral filmmakers to advocates. And the second and third films are, I think, pieces of advocacy, where the first film, I think, is a piece of journalism. And that's the difference.
How much directorial license have you to fiddle with sequence of chronology and to exclude certain complicating facts in order to make the story more understandable, more seamless, and more powerful?
Any documentary is a compression of time. You know, presenting a 6-week murder trial in Paradise Lost in a 2.5-hour film is a compression of time, which is by definition a manipulation of chronology. That's a given. But what is not acceptable, in my opinion, is overtly telling an audience that something happened on this date when in fact it happened on another date. And so it's a delicate dance, but that's the difference between a good documentary and a bad documentary. There's a fine line between exploitation and investigation, and you always have to be aware not to tip into the exploitation part of the equation.
We discussed the scene where the star on the top of the Christmas tree at the gravesite cast a shadow of a pentagram on the head of one of the grieving step-parents. And an hour and a half later, you come to realize that, holy moly, I think this guy might be the killer. Did you withhold anything from the audience for the sake of the ensuing drama?
If you're asking me, do documentarians and do I selectively withhold information until the right dramatic moment, the answer is yes, because you can't present every moment at the moment it happens, because mathematically you can't show your entire story at one moment. There is a thing called running time of a movie that you have to fill. You have to thread the needle in such a way that you keep your audience and that you have an unfolding narrative. I mean, that's called filmmaking.
So on the subject of unfolding narrative, when Andrew Jarecki unfolded the probably incriminating evidence of a Robert Durst penned envelope next to an apparently Robert Durst penned letter to the Beverly Hills police, which would have made him, in his own words, the only possible killer. That happened a couple years earlier than we were perhaps led to believe. Did that, as a filmmaker, make you squeamish?
Good question. I am not in favor of giving false information to an audience for obvious reasons, but I am okay with holding off giving information until the right dramatic moment, because that is the nature of storytelling.
If I haven't misheard you, there is a structural conflict between the role of a documentarian to seek truth and his responsibilities as a filmmaker to spin out the most compelling narrative. Is it possible to do both to the utmost at the same time?
A documentarian must be committed to a truthful presentation of the facts. But in my book, emotional truthfulness is a valid form of truthfulness. You want to give the emotional truth of a situation. Chronology gets manipulated by the act of filmmaking. It doesn't mean you can overtly manipulate chronology. A documentary needs to have balance, but it doesn't mean you need to put every fact and to counterpoint every fact, because then the film would be endless. It's a series of decisions. And I think what separates good documentaries from bad documentaries is finding that balance between truthfulness and storytelling.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Berlinger is a filmmaker, most recently of Whitey, the United States of America versus James Bulger. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Kasia Mihailovich, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Jesse Brenneman and Julia Hsu. And our show was edited by, this week, executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.